This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Today, we bring you two interviews which have aired previously on the program. Coming up, retired Eastern Michigan University professor and author Bob Duke. Duke, who has his PhD from Western Michigan University, discusses his book on President Lyndon Johnson and Congressman Bob Pogue. But first, in May, we sat down with two Western Michigan University students who have developed a device to help premature infants in underdeveloped countries. I spoke with Joseph Barnett and Stephen John, who joined us via Skype. Gentlemen, thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So let's begin with the problem that you saw and what was out there that made you say, these hospitals are going to need something different.
Eric Chang, a respiratory therapist who I had met while I was in Nepal, told me about how for infants requiring a basic level of treatment, CPAP, there were great devices that were in place in these rural hospitals, but for sicker babies requiring additional treatment, a dual level treatment, similar to like a BiPAP, there wasn't anything. And so you have these kids that need additional treatment that's not available at these local centers. And so often they would die on the 5 to 6 to 10 hour drives to larger cities with those facilities. And so there wasn't treatment that was affordable, that was low power, that was easy enough to use to where these rural medical centers could treat these babies.
And that's rural Nepal?
Yes.
And these are babies usually suffering from respiratory distress induced by premature birth.
So explain exactly how this new device works.
Yeah, so it's really been tailored to work off. So there's a treatment that works well. It's used all around the world, bubble CPAP, that gives this basic first level of respiratory treatment. And we've really tailored our design to work off of that treatment so that there's just an exhaust pipe in that treatment. And if you remove that pipe and replace it with our device, the rest of the circuit being the same, you can now provide this dual level treatment. In other words, there's a low level of pressure, but there's also a high level of pressure, and you cycle between those. And that's helpful for these sicker infants suffering from moderate to severe respiratory distress syndrome.
And what it does is that these infants have trouble keeping their lungs open and breathing, and so it prevents lung collapse and enables them to breathe in and out with this dual level pressure.
Yeah, so formally it's the functional unit of the lungs, the alveoli. The treatment helps recruit and stabilize those alveoli. So if you think of it as like a bunch of small balloons, it's almost like the air with positive pressure is keeping those balloons inflated for the baby. So the baby's still breathing on their own, but this positive pressure keeps those balloons inflated and it reduces the work of breathing.
So that those sacs, those little balloons, don't collapse.
So it's a very inexpensive device. I mean, how much does it cost to put something like this together?
It's a lot less than what's currently out there in the States, that's for sure. We're looking at selling it for a few dollars versus thousands of dollars in the States for something like a BiPAP machine or a ventilator that's capable of delivering this treatment. So if centers are already set up with the existing treatment bubble CPAP, they can pretty easily add on our adapter device for, say, $20 or $25 or something like that.
And still be able to, at the end of the day, save many lives that otherwise might not be.
Yes, sir.
Where do things stand right now in terms of getting this into more hospitals?
Yeah, so we've got a working prototype in the lab, which produces clinically relevant pressure waveforms. So what do we mean by clinically relevant? Well, the lower level of pressure and the upper level of pressure, and then the amount of time that it spends at each of those. It's about a second at the lower level of pressure and half a second at the higher level. All of those that our machine currently delivers correspond to what respiratory therapists will typically deliver to these premature babies. So we've got the working prototype in the lab. We've also got I'm an engineer, so we've got a simulation, a numerical model as well that's in good agreement with our prototypes. Joe's working with another engineering student in the lab quite extensively now to do a lot of testing with 3D printed prototypes. And then once we've really finalized our design, we're going to produce it by injection molding, hopefully by the end of this month, maybe within 2 months at the latest. And then we'll have 500 or so of these devices ready to use.
And would that be strictly for Nepal, or are there other nations where you might be able to get these also into hospitals?
We would probably be initially starting with Nepal, just because you need to get the clearance from the Health Research Council And then the hospital's institutional review board needs to also approve it. And so we know how to do that process in Nepal. So it would be natural to start in Nepal and expand to its 93 different hospitals. But the need is definitely very widespread. And we've had some contact with doctors all around the world. For example, one in Burundi who have requested the device once it's ready for patient use.
We anticipate eventually, once kind of proving the concept in Nepal, being able to expand out into places like Burundi, or we've talked about India or Indonesia, where there are millions of respiratory deaths induced by respiratory distress from premature infants.
Let's go back a bit. Both of you have done some, I guess, work, missionary work, I don't know if that would be the right word, which has maybe exposed you to allow you to see some things that a lot of us in the United States don't see on a regular basis. You know, kind of describe what you see out there in terms of the healthcare system in a place like Nepal. Would it be surprising to someone in the United States just what is there and maybe not there?
I think that a lot of people are aware that there are, you know, health disparities out there, but many people, other than seeing a commercial or a picture online, they haven't actually experienced that. And so going to a place like Honduras or Nepal and getting on a bus and traveling for hours, you know, and then getting into a car and traveling on dirt roads for hours, and then getting to a hospital where you see these health disparities firsthand, it is pretty surprising and shocking.
And Stephen, you spent some time in Nepal when you were growing up, right?
Yeah, so I, between the ages of 5 and 16, actually lived in Nepal. That was our base. And now I've gone back most summers since then. I think similar to what Joe was saying, you know, just in general, there's so many disparities, you know, the quality of the roads and how rural the setting is and whatnot. But I think for me, like, I was very impressed. And I think often people underestimate the excellence of care that can be delivered in these settings. And there's a lot of sort of innovative thinking with, like, improvising and making do with what you have to still provide excellent care. And I think one huge difference is that money is a very significant factor. And so if you're a patient coming in with your premature baby, you'll think very seriously before you agree to treatment, just because if that's going to cost you your family farm, including your two buffalo and your land, and then you'll have no way of supporting your other three kids. It's not like, well, yes, treat him at whatever the cost. Well, the family has to actually think about that very carefully and make a decision based on, you know, the community and how much everyone can pitch in to help. And so I think out of that environment, you sort of have this crunch where you need to design stuff that will produce very similar results to the West, but at a fraction of the cost.
And I think one of the things that the hospital in Tonsan and also in Honduras, in Balfate, both hospitals are really trying to provide treatment at a very affordable price to these people so that it costs just a fraction of what it would cost in the States, but they're still receiving excellent care from well-trained physicians who really care about those people.
So I think one nice way to sum it up is you're seeking to provide excellent medical care on a shoestring budget. You can't compromise the excellent aspect. Otherwise, you're not doing anyone a favor, but you have to keep in mind the budget with which you're doing it.
For both of you, as you go forward, you're both seniors. Is medicine something you intend to pursue? And I guess, do you see yourself always kind of doing what you can to help out an area of the world like Nepal or perhaps another country which is still developing?
Definitely. Stephen and I both plan to attend medical school, and long-term, we both like to practice medicine in low-resource settings or developing countries like Nepal and Honduras.
Yeah, and I think one, I am to stress there, for both of us, and then obviously for me personally, but I think also for Joe, we're looking at that as sort of the long-term, what we'll be doing with most of our time, so like a full-time. So I'm going to the University of Michigan's med school, starting in August, actually, and then after all of that training's done, I'm anticipating going to somewhere like Nepal or a similar setting and working there full time, practicing medicine, and then also hopefully designing medical equipment for that area.
I've traveled to Honduras 6 times, and I think once you do that enough times, once you see the need, it doesn't really leave you. And so that's kind of a lot of my inspiration for wanting to be a physician, is working in those settings and seeing that people really do need healthcare and it's a real thing, and they're not receiving it in a lot of places. And so that's stuck with me, and that's kind of been a lot of the energy that I've put into my coursework and my research and all of that sort of thing.
Would you also like to both pursue, perhaps, opportunities to develop more medical devices, the sort of things which can help poorer part of the world with something like premature babies. I mean, do you see that as maybe part of the career path going forward as well?
Yep. So I definitely do. So as you know, I studied mechanical engineering for my undergrad, and I definitely don't want that to be a waste. And right now, while I'm in Nepal, I'm helping the biomedical department repair equipment. And so I definitely see continuing that in the future.
Yeah, and continuing it in a way that was similar, I think, to this project, in that we saw this need and someone presented it to us, and then we thought about it and said, how can we design something that would be affordable and easy to use, relatively easy to use for people practicing medicine in developing countries? And so I think we'll both have an opportunity to see those sort of needs in the future, and that will enable us to continue doing this.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Joseph Barnett is a senior majoring in biomedical sciences at Western Michigan University. He has joined us in studio. Stephen John is a senior as well, majoring in biomedical sciences and mechanical engineering. He is in Nepal, and he joined us via Skype. The interview with Joseph Barnett and Stephen John first aired in May. This week, it was announced that the NeoVent is this year's winner of the 2015 James Dyson Award, which is given for design, technology, and research education. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Late last year, retired Eastern Michigan University professor Bob Duke visited our studios. Duke, who has a PhD from Western Michigan University, is the author of LBJ and Grassroots Federalism, Congressman Bob Pogue, Race and Change in Texas. Bob Duke, thank you for being here.
Good morning, Gordon. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin by talking about Congressman Bob Pogue. Why is he, as you say in this book, a footnote to history?
People in the audience today who are interested in the life and career of Lyndon Johnson might know works by Robert Caro, Robert Dallek. Many noted biographers have addressed Johnson's life. But Bob Pogue is an example of a key ally of Lyndon Johnson's who slipped through the cracks. I conclude that the reason that this happened is that while Johnson is famous for becoming a crusader for civil rights, his longtime friend and colleague in a neighboring congressional district, Bob Pogue, remained a staunch segregationist. And historians have not been spending a lot of time with the segregationists, the South's second lost cause. And we understand the reasons for that, but I found the relationship between the two men fascinating.
So as we sit here in 2014, and yes, people still talk about Lyndon Johnson. New books come out pretty regularly. We probably have not read the last historical treatment of Lyndon Johnson's presidency or his time in Congress, for that matter, and in the Senate. Why should we know more about Bob Pogue?
Well, I think what brought me to this topic was the same kind of frustration that many citizens feel. Our system simply doesn't seem to be working very well, our political system at the federal level and state and local issues as well. And I wanted to look back at the career of Lyndon Johnson, who is noted for being able to untangle the complex webs that snag the political process so often. I wanted to look at his career, and in doing so, I needed to examine his relationship with other politicians. And I found that by concentrating on a single place, Waco, Texas, I could see the fruits of their labor best. And the book focuses on, therefore, what these two men did to bring federal resources to Waco, Texas.
And is that what you mean by grassroots federalism, as you say in the title?
One of the things that I think is a mistaken conception about the Great Society programs is that somehow or other critics of those programs have painted a picture that everything was top down. Actually, the excessive control by the federal government is more a product of the 70s. Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue were both products of the New Deal. And one of the things that characterized those programs were local people involved in delivering federal services. When the federal government set up the National Youth Administration programs here in Kalamazoo, for example, or in Waco, Texas, these were staffed by the local citizenry. And when they set up advisory councils to determine how to spend federal resources, the decisions were made largely by the local stakeholders. I found that this is a characteristic of Lyndon Johnson's political philosophy that you can trace all the way through the Great Society: grassroots citizen involvement.
You open this book with the story of a dedication of a dam in Waco in 1958, which, as you note, was something that was not going to necessarily live on in the history books. It was an interesting news story for that day. But why do you begin by focusing on that? What does that tell us about Lyndon Johnson, Bob Pogue, and what they were trying to do as members of Congress?
Let me give you just a little bit of the landscape of Waco, Texas first. The city was founded just below the confluence of two rivers, the Bosque River and the Brazos. And proximity to water makes a lot of sense if you're settling in Texas. But as Waco grew, a characteristic of the river systems became more and more of a problem. Those rivers flooded horribly. When the rains came, they tended to come all at once, and incredible damage. So the riverfront district in Waco was largely of marginal use. The city of Waco and leaders in that city had been trying desperately since the early 1900s to solve this problem. It wasn't until Lyndon Johnson became Senate Majority Leader and Bob Pogue was at a pinnacle of his power in the House of Representatives that they were finally able to bring the federal resources to Waco and to solve this problem. If you've been to Waco recently, you know that Baylor University has expanded enormously in recent years. There is no way they could have built their new football stadium alongside the Brazos River if Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue had not worked cooperatively with the citizens of Waco to bring that dam to the city.
So they made government work for their constituents in Texas.
Yes, and there were political rewards for that. They were elected consistently. Johnson, of course, moved up the food chain, as we all know. Bob Pogue, however, remained in Congress for 21 terms.
And became chairman of the Agriculture Committee, which, as you say, is maybe part of the reason he is not better remembered, because agriculture is not one of those areas that people look back on often and see where power was being used, etc. But he certainly did use that to his advantage and the advantage of the people he represented in Texas.
In the parlance of today's politics, he was a player at the time. John Kennedy considered Bob Pogue for the position of Secretary of Agriculture when Kennedy took the White House himself in 1961. But the job went to Orville Freeman of Minnesota instead. The Kennedy administration was not interested in fighting any battles with Congress over the appointment of a segregationist to a cabinet position.
So there was a ceiling on his career, in part because of his position on race and civil rights.
I don't think that Bob Pogue, at least judging from what he said in oral histories that I've read and from his own autobiography, I don't think that Bob Pogue ever really latched onto the idea that his stubbornness on the issue of segregation not only hurt his own career, but it hurt the city of Waco.
How so?
Let me give Exhibit A. In the 1950s, during the Cold War, one of the biggest plums that any politician could bring home to the people was a military base. And sure enough, Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue worked together to bring the 12th Air Force, as it was that division of the Air Force, was going to come to Waco at the James Connolly Air Base. And that was established in 1957. When Lyndon Johnson won his full term in the White House with the sweeping victory in November of 1964, one of the very first things he decided to do was to close that air base in Waco, Texas, and move it to Austin, Texas. Reason being, this is very clear, and it's classic Johnson politics, Representative Jake Pickle of Austin had voted in favor of the Civil Rights Act, one of five Southern House members to do so, and Bob Pogue voted against it. So Johnson knew how to use power, and Waco paid a very high price for Bob Pogue's segregationist posture.
And that is kind of a key moment in the Johnson-Pogue relationship, isn't it, this decision with the Air Force Base?
Yes, there's no question that this was devastating to Pogue in many ways. It's not to say that his career was ruined. He continued to represent Waco for more than a decade after that. But the elites in town, the business establishment that was far more progressive on matters of race than might be commonly thought, had major problems with Pogue's handling of that matter.
I want to read from a little bit here at the end of chapter 3 in your book to get a little bit more into this issue of civil rights and race. Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue supported each other like the friends and true believers they were. But somewhere between that bluebonnet-lined highway from Austin to Waco and what activists would call the road to freedom, Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue parted company. And you go on to say that Pogue and LBJ agreed on so much, including the vital role that citizens play in shaping the destiny of the community they call home, but they differed on who could live in that community. Explain a little bit more about where this division started. Is there a starting point where we can say Lyndon Johnson and Bob Pogue just took separate paths?
Well, Johnson's evolution on the issue of civil rights is something that all of his biographers give attention to, rightfully so. One of the things that got me into this study in the first place was wondering, at what point could a white man in the South stand up among his peers and say, this is wrong. We cannot continue to live this way any longer. Johnson argued throughout his career, particularly once he had come out, so to speak, on civil rights, that it was all a matter of timing, that it didn't do any good to be on the cutting edge of something if you weren't in a position of power to do anything about it. By the late 50s, Johnson begins to show his hand with some legislative moves that result in some weak civil rights bills in Congress. At this point, the relationship between Pogue and Johnson isn't in danger because I don't think that Bob Pogue, or Lyndon Johnson for that matter, imagined that history would move in such a way that it would be Lyndon Johnson that would inherit the mantle of the presidency at a time when the issue simply had to be dealt with. So I don't think this is a moment that both dreaded, a moment of truth, so to speak. I don't think it's like that. I think it's Johnson's sense of what needed to be done on a moral and just for the federal government to be able to keep peace in the country, the issue simply had to be dealt with. Pogue argued for all of his life that the problems in Waco weren't that bad and Waco could handle it on its own.
Did the different approach that Johnson and Pogue had on race and civil rights stem from the fact that while they were from neighboring congressional districts, those districts were very different in makeup and culture and those sort of things?
Here in Michigan, we're well acquainted with how different places like Metro Detroit can be from places like Harrison, Michigan in the north central part of the state. If one hasn't been to Texas, the diversity of the state in terms of landscape and political culture and practically any measure you have is really quite extraordinary. Johnson happened to grow up in a portion of the state that was heavily settled by German immigrants and strongly anti-slavery immigrants. And so that colored much of Texas history, and Central Texas, South Central Texas in particular, is noted even today as being a unique oasis of liberalism. Think of images people have of Austin, Texas. It's thought of as the Ann Arbor of the state.
Right.
Maybe not so much anymore. But the hill country that Johnson grew up in is a place where slavery never really took root, not only because of the German settlement, but also because of just the landscape wasn't suitable for it. Pogue, however, grew up in the Blackland Prairie area of Texas, where slavery took hold pretty deeply. Pogue grew up with African-American domestics in his parents' household. Johnson experienced nothing like that. So it's geography, it's the way they were brought up, nature and nurture.
Which leads us to a very interesting point in this story of civil rights and these two longtime friends who had served in Congress together for a good chunk of their lives. Lyndon Johnson, as president, is now trying to get the votes that he needs for the Civil Rights Act. Lyndon Johnson is known at that time and still throughout history as a man who could get people to change their minds on deep-seated issues, things where you couldn't think you could move people. And yet he never, at any point goes to his friend, Bob Pogue, and tries to get him to vote for the Civil Rights Act. What was Lyndon Johnson thinking by not even making the effort?
The best I can figure, because I'm not sure that any of us can really get inside LBJ's head, but the best I can figure is that he did the math. Part of his mastery of the Senate, to use Robert Caro's characterization, is that Johnson knew how to count votes. And when he had enough, he had enough. And the situation in the House of Representatives with the Civil Rights Act was not nearly as tenuous as getting past a Senate filibuster. So the play that's gotten so much attention on Broadway, All the Way, with Bryan Cranston, focuses on Johnson's persuasion during this time. He was using every minute of every day to get that bill through Congress. He simply didn't need Bob Pogue's vote. That's what it boiled down to. He simply didn't need the vote.
Perhaps showing how Lyndon Johnson is the ultimate politician, that he would not chase after a vote he didn't need, because instead he's going to go after the votes that he does need, and he's not going to worry about his personal relationship with Bob Pogue or anything else. It's get the votes that we need to get past the filibuster.
That's right. And it's interesting that at no point did Bob Pogue put two and two together and realize that he was looking over a cliff in terms of his future relationship with Lyndon Johnson. There was no indication that Pogue ever wavered on this and thought, well, wait a minute, I better support this or I'm going to be on the outs with the president.
But could Bob Pogue have also been thinking, if I do vote for the Civil Rights Act, it's going to make it really tough on me when I go back home and have to run for re-election?
That certainly proved to be the case for in the South, that by the late 60s, it became harder and harder for progressive Democrats to be elected. A good, strong conservative like Bob Pogue was in good shape, though. So he knew his district well, and I'm certain that one of the reasons why he never gave serious consideration to supporting the federal action on civil rights is that just as Johnson didn't need Pogue's vote, Pogue didn't need to vote for it to stay in office.
To bring this back around to Bob Pogue's place in history for a moment, if he had worked with Lyndon Johnson on the issue of civil rights in the same way that he worked with him on bringing a dam to Waco, on all sorts of projects for making life better in Texas, would somebody else have written a book by now about Bob Pogue?
That's a great question. Let's put it this way. I think that there are show horses and there are workhorses. A professor I had here at Western, Chet Rogers, was the one who introduced me to that expression. And what Chet meant by that is that I think there are a lot of people in the state legislature, in city commissions, in the Congress of the United States, who are doing excellent work, but they aren't the ones who find themselves in front of the microphone all the time. I'm not sure that it was ever Bob Pogue's fate to be famous. And given his attitude on segregation, perhaps he deserves much of the time that he's spent in the shadows. But if we want any guidance on how our political system can work better today, we have to look back to a time not so far away when people with rather drastically different views on things could work together in the common interest of the public that they served. It's almost like we've lost the car keys and we can't figure out how to get back to where we once were. And I'm hoping that maybe this book will contribute to helping us find those keys again.
Bob Duke, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Bob Duke is a retired Eastern Michigan University professor. He has a PhD from Western Michigan University. His book is called LBJ and Grassroots Federalism, Congressman Bob Pogue, Race and Change in Texas. The interview with Bob Duke originally aired in November. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.